And his most recent book with Sally Tomlinson was published in January, Rule Britannia, Brexit and the End of Empire, which is concerning the EU referendum and the 2019 exit.
Thank you. Thank you ever so much for coming. I'm going to really try very hard for this, apart from the last two slides, not to be critical. In fact, I thought I might even slightly take on the persona of a Leaver, just to turn that. So, because what I wanted to do, because it's Skeptics in a Pub, is talk about the most nerdy aspect of Brexit, which I don't think has got enough attention, and it's very, very geographical. The book talks about a lot more, and as you can guess from the title and the picture, we go way back to the Empire and try and find the reasons behind the reasons behind the reasons for why, of all the 28 countries of the EU, it's this one that's actually tried to leave first. But that's not what I'm interested in tonight. I'm interested in this very strange phenomena of blaming working class people, blaming people in the north, saying it was because of them that we left. When I think, I hope you agree with me by the time I finish, which will be at exactly 10 past, I think it is really, really simple to see that it wasn't. And then the interesting question is, why? Why, if so much of the vote was in the south of England, do we not accept that? Do we not talk about it? This man, I put his picture up. It's not Benedict Cumberbatch. He was played by Miss Dominic Cummings. I don't know where he's gone. So that's the reason for the picture. If any of you have seen Dominic, do let me know. One thing I'll say, I think the result was surprising, at least the geography result was surprising. And my personal theory is that the people campaigning most to secure leave didn't expect to get it the first time. Dominic's quite a clever lad. If he had thought that they were going to win, I think he would have covered his tracks better. And he wouldn't have done things that might end him up in court, I'm using my words carefully. And so part of what's interesting about the vote is that it may have actually even surprised the people who were trying to get it up. And then there's a question about why did we get the vote like this? Correlations. You like correlations? Yes, good, good. Lots and lots of people. Lots of people did instant analysis. This came out within 3 weeks of the result. So many academics, I mean, you know, you have a series of numbers, 400 odd, for each local authority. You've got lots of other data for local authority. You can put them against each other. What gets you the best correlation? I won't name the person who did this one. He was absolutely taken apart by the Daily Express and the Sun and the Mail. I feel okay talking about this. I used to be thin. But so that I can talk about this without prejudice, if you're wondering what obese and not healthy weight is, I hover between the two. Point 8 correlation. Point 8. Between the proportion of people who were obese in each local authority and the proportion voting leave. The academic who found this suggested it was because people who eat more are more feckless and don't think carefully. You can see why he got into trouble. There are lots of other reasons about why this might well be a correlation, but it's not at all causal. Point 8. Okay, the highest. I'm only going to show you one more. This is 0.03. Which is the lowest I've managed to find that's still positive. It's a correlation between the government's official measure of deprivation, index of multiple deprivation, and again the lead load. So, I don't know if this little light might be, oh, that isn't a little light. Maybe, no, you have to just bear with me. Down here towards me, you have areas which have a fairly high rate of deprivation, Liverpool, Manchester, Birmingham, ambulances and so on, low lead load. You have other areas with high deprivation, Great Yarmouth, Hull, high lead load. But then you have areas with low deprivation, East Dorset, Watchford, Havering, with a high lead load. You may see a pattern in that. You might take London out in your INC something. What's fascinating about the deprivation voting relationship is that when you look in different parts of the country, you find different patterns. So in London and Oxford, it's the poorer parts of those cities that are more likely to have more people voting Leave. But in somewhere like Devon, it's the more affluent parts of Devon that have more people voting Leave. And that pattern across the country ends up with a cancelling out and nothing going on. So that's a geographical correlation. Most important thing, the most important statistics is the very, very, very simple statistics. Now this is based on surveys, and it's by age, and this is the one key thing to get in your head. But it's pretty accurate surveys. 18 to 24 year olds, of those who voted, most voted Remain, small number vote Leave, but 70% did not vote. That's really important. I'm going to go on about this and I'm going to annoy you. Turnout and the differential turnout of different groups was key to the result. As you get older, your propensity to actually turn out and vote goes up very highly. It's almost a religious thing. I do it, I'm old. And the proportion who vote Leave is a majority. It's a majority from about age 45 onwards. So the distribution of people by age is going to be really important. If you've got an area with lots of young people, it's more likely to be Remain. But also, it wouldn't take very many older people to actually beat those young people because those young people were in bed. It's not that I'm not having a particular going at young people. The first election at which the vote on young collapsed was 1992. And it's directly after the poll tax. So if you want to stop young people voting, introduce a tax, which is the same regardless of your income, and they'll disappear from their register. When you ask people if they voted, around about 90% will remember voting now. I won't. Let's do, I did it sometimes. Who didn't vote? Here, who didn't vote? Well done, honest, honest. Right, for you too, there's at least there are 5 or 6 people in the room who know they didn't, but don't want to admit. It's okay. But much more interestingly, there'll be another 5, 6, maybe 8 or 9 or 10 of you who didn't vote, but you've constructed a memory that you did. Now we know this because when you go and vote for general elections, you know, they take a ruler and draw a line and get your line on. That's a public document. I think it's destroyed about 3 months afterwards, but researchers are allowed access to it. Anybody can get access to it. So when we do surveys of voting, and we knock on the door and say, would you mind being surveyed and so on, one thing we do is we then go and check what's called the marked up roll to see who didn't actually vote, but have given us a whole history of how they voted and what they did. And it isn't necessarily lying. We all recreate memories of ourselves. My prediction is that in 5 to 10 years' time, when we ask the population of Britain whether they voted and what they did in the referendum, we'll get a very different answer from what actually happened. But it'll be an answer that's in your head. This is how we get through life. You know, I've been a wonderful person all my life. I've always been kind to my friends and my family. You know, that's the kind of thing you do. The map. The map that's come from Wikipedia is the European elections of 2014. The purple in the local appointed districts, because I think we did get the results today, although it's a weird PR system, where UKIP got the most votes. And it's a really interesting geography. It's kind of, it's on the edge. That is the geography of ageing Britain. The essentially youngsters crowd into cities now, like never before, partly because we've got universities in all our cities, and half of all young women go to university. Then the men try and follow them, but they don't do quite as well. And then, after that, they go off to other cities, often bigger cities, disproportionately. But come age 40, 45, you begin to move out. And you move further and further and further, if you're lucky enough to age, to end up bang up against the coast. If you divorce, you do it even faster. But anyway, that's the pattern. So there's an interesting pattern for you. Just a couple more things. This is a weird kind of diagram, but you are skeptics in the past, so this diagram on the y-axis is the support for far-right parties, National Front, BNP and UKIP. And then on the x-axis is the speed of change in the support. And the reason for showing you this, it begins at about 1% in 1997. It's really low. It goes up each time there's a European election. More of the population just before the European election decide that they want to vote for parties that advise the Conservatives. Way up to a heady 14% in 2014. It's now right down where it was. So a week ago, it was down at 1%. 3 or 4 days ago, it was back up again with the magic Nigel. His amazing ability. But the point of that was to show there hasn't been a kind of steady rise. It's something that gets whipped up and then disappears again. This, I think, is fascinating. This is the proportion of people at each European election we've had. The first was 1979. Who voted far right? Different definition of far right on this graph. The definition of far right in this graph is voting for a party aligned to a group in the European Parliament that is to advise of something called the EPP. Who knows what the EPP is? Two people, I think one way, three, four, five, six. That's amazing, isn't it? Okay, more if you do know. I went up. The EPP is the biggest block of parties in the European Parliament. It is essentially the Conservatives of Europe. It's the one Merkel is in. It's the one our Conservatives were in, election after election after election. It is the right wing of Europe, the strongest block of parliamentarians in the European Union. Way back in 1979, who voted in 79? Well, there was a general election as well. You're worried, okay. If you might remember, I remember in the late 70s, the National Front were doing quite well until 79. They didn't actually put up any candidates. So the far right got zero. The far right got zero in 84. In 89, they got about 0.1% of the vote. 94, 1.1%. We then had the referendum party and so on. By that time, it's 7.5%. By 2004, with UKIP doing well, it's a fifth of the vote, 20%. The Conservatives left the EPP by 2009. I gave half their votes to this, hence the 37. By 2014, the Conservatives had joined a group in Europe with Alternative for Deutschland. You might argue with me later, I think it's fair enough to call it, well, to the right of mainstream European Conservatives. 52.4%, possibly 52.9%, depending on how you treat various unionist parties, of people who voted in 2014 voted for what would be considered far right in the mainland. We didn't bat an eyelid, really. If you look at the European Parliament, you look at the MEPs who make up the bulk of the far-right coalitions, they're British. We we are the far right core bedrock of Europe. There's the odd one free Finn, there's one person from Sweden, occasionally somebody from Greece. 40 of our MEPs. So that's the background. Before I get on to what I really want to get on to, which is some geography. This is a map of migration in Europe. The dark blue areas are where over a fifth of people were born in another country. The data for 2014 is the best data Eurostat have. The yellow areas, pale yellow, is less than 5%. So, and it's stretched, sorry. I'm assuming you're extremely nerdy. It's stretched so that areas proportional to population. To stop you looking at Scandinavia. Scandinavia is really interesting and very nice if you're a kind of Guardian meeting remainer. But it's, I've got to remember, for people who I'm being tonight. But it's small, it's unimportant. Whereas what this map does, and maps drawn like this do, is make sure you're looking at the things that matter. The amount of colour is proportional to the amount of people. Eastern Europe is yellow. Istanbul, this is Turkey. Look, and they're all going to come. I'm just getting into character. They're all just about to come. We only just stopped them. Yellow. Parts of rural western France over here is yellow. And most of the UK is yellow, because we are a low immigration country. Most of the UK is. Most of the UK, less than 1 in 20 people were born abroad. How many people here were born abroad, not in the UK? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, great. Less than 5%. Good. And you are not normal people. So you this, people who come along on an evening like this and a talk like this are not representative. But still, you know, it is quite stunning. London, if we were in London, particularly west central London, dark blue, over 1 in 5 people. If we were in Ireland, Ireland's a really fascinating one. Absolutely full of immigrants in Ireland. Because I must have run out. I really must have run out of time. They're born on the other side of the thing that isn't a line. Okay? I won't do any further. That's the vast majority of people in Ireland who are not born in the country they're in, were born on the other side of the thing which isn't a line. Right, let's do this quickly. There's the result of the map. I was going to talk about north-south divide, but what I've got to say, it doesn't matter. Boris goes. He's been quiet as well. It doesn't matter where you draw the north-south divide for what we're going to talk about. You can either draw it that way, diagonally, or you can do it horizontally, it makes no difference. 52% of people who voted Leave lived in the south of England, or the UK, 52%. A fairly crucial majority. And that's not because the south of England had more electors. The Brexit way. I'm trying to work out how do you get this over to people. And I thought the way to do it is you actually create a national walk. So, when people are willing to do the Pennine way, and that's a bit miserable, I did for 10 years in Sheffield. And then you land into John O'Groats. This is more of a challenge. I'd actually do it on the coastal route to begin with to kind of encourage you, because that's quite pretty at the start. Let's just go through it. You start off in Cornwall, then Isles of Scilly. You're in an area with 56.5% of people voted Leave. Into Devon, 55. Dorset back up to 56.5. Hampshire, 54. Quite typical of the South England. You can hop over to the Isle of Wight if you want to get some really strong Leave voting, almost 62%. Sussex, narrow majority, a bit too near London, a bit too easy to get to London. But Kent, almost 60%. Essex, well over 60%. Suffolk, 57%. Norfolk, 56%. Even Cambridgeshire, 50.5%. Hertfordshire, still a majority. Bedfordshire, a majority. Northamptonshire, almost 60%. Warwickshire, 55-ish. West Midlands, almost 60%. Worcestershire, 57%. Hertfordshire, almost got to 60%. Gloucestershire, not doing so well. Too much Guardian again. 51.5. Somerset, 52.3. Jacob Rees-Mogg land. Bristol, bit of a downer. Going to Bristol, we've only got 38%. You quickly get out of Bristol, go to Wiltshire, you back up to the land of the true, 53%. Berkshire, not really English, 47%. Oxfordshire, terrible place, 43%. Buckinghamshire, almost good, 49.5%. I actually spent quite a lot of time in Buckinghamshire. Surrey, even Surrey, 47.8%. London, 40%. Quite high. And then the tiny city of London, the home of the traitors, just 24.7%. If you want to know who's most annoyed, by the way, in Britain at the moment, it's the city of London. They thought they had purchased the political party. Anyway. Right. Cornwall. This gets repetitive, but it's only a little bit fast. 56.5% of people who voted leave. We're going to compare it with a set of areas. The areas will always be different. In this case, the areas we're looking at is the Nottinghamshire Coalfield, and it's 56.6. So you can look at that and you can say, oh, but the Coalfield of Nottinghamshire was more Leave than Cornwall. However, look at the absolute numbers. In Cornwall, it's 183,286 Leavers, and in Nottinghamshire Coalfield, it's only 181. And all that matters is the total vote, not the percentages. This is about a single number. So Cornwall produces more Leave voters than the Coalfield, even though the Coalfield had a higher percentage, and the reason is turnout. And this is crucial, because people in Cornwall go and vote. People in the next coal mining area are much more likely not to. The electorate of Cornwall, 421,000, is much smaller than the 459,000 in the coalfield. It's marginal, but we talk about people in depressed parts of Nottinghamshire being leavers, as yet I've not seen anybody report about Cornwall. Devon, 55.3% leaving. Less than I've created anti-Devon is North Wales. Kind of UKIP territory and Gateshead, even Lakeland, County Durham. But again, more Leave voters, 377,000 from Devon, just a few less from those parts of the north, despite the electorate of Devon being lower because people turned out to vote in Devon. They vote and they vote Leave, whereas in the north it's less. Dorset, 249,000 Leave voters. As compared to, in this case, Northumberland, North and South Tyneside, and Torfaen, which is a very depressed part of Wales, which produced 235,000 Leavers, despite having more people with the right to vote on the electoral roll. Hampshire, congratulations. 546,000. And just look at the areas I'm comparing Hampshire to. Merthyr Tydfil. Wales as a whole actually voted spot on the UK average. But for some reason we thought it was okay for us to go to Wales and say, why could they do this? All they actually did was vote average, but we, by we I mean the English elite who control the press, decided to have a go at the Welsh. Leeds, Blackpool, Sheffield, and Great Yarmouth, which are stuck in the north for this, and Derby. More voters voting Leave in Hampshire than all those areas combined, despite those areas combined having a higher electorate. Isle of Wight, for some reason I put Luton in the north. This is when I'm starting off with this, but just to point out, people think of Luton as a kind of relatively depressed area. Isle of Wight produces absolutely more Leave voters and a higher proportion. Sussex manages to beat places like North Lincolnshire, Lindsay, North East Lincolnshire. They're real hotbeds to Leave. Sussex, you kind of think of RT commuters. But you don't actually think, remember the age thing. There are many, many more older people in the south of England, and they live for longer. And they still go along and vote. Kent, 576,000 voters. producing more Leave voters than the combined Hull, Calderdale, Sunderland. Somebody should go and apologise to Sunderland. I mean, it's their fault partly for declaring early. But nobody panned a camera in on two bald blokes and a woman in Kent, at least originally. Salford, Preston, Bradford, Stoke, Chesterfield and Anglesey. All these areas that are traditionally associated with Leave produce less Leave voters than Kent. But the best is Essex. 622,000 voters. Anti-Essex, I can't get it all on, we've got Blenheim, Brent, Lincoln, Rutland, and Emmycock, Carlisle, Alderdale, Copeland, Craven, Lancaster, Barrow, Whipple, Pendle, Highburn. I just won't go through them. Fewer actual votes despite more electors. I don't know if this is the best way to try to get this over, but, and I might be slightly obsessed by this, but I am a professor of geography. And the one thing we know for absolute certain is exactly how many people voted in each area and how they voted. Everything else is a survey. Some very good surveys, but this isn't a survey. Suffolk, more Leave voters than Burnley, Crawley, Fife, and I haven't fixed this. Right? This is not something you can fix. You could fix any one of these individually, but you can't fix the whole lot. More Leave voters in Norfolk than in North East Derbyshire, Bolsover. I have brought some Scottish ones in because you've got to get them in. Cambridgeshire, more Leave voters. I know you're getting bored, Hertfordshire. You're going to get the message that zoom on. Northamptonshire, Warwickshire. Comparing it to Sefton and the Wibble. The stereotype was unfair. It's always Marshall. In all these cases, it's just a few thousand more voters voting Leave. But it's not the story that's been told. West Midlands. Huge number of Leave voters. Compared to areas which have a different kind of stereotype to West Midlands. It's quite a long walk. I can't imagine anybody actually doing it. I kind of thought these could be little signs on the way. If you'd made it, it would kind of tell you. Could be there in 100 years' time. Kind of commemorate 2016, June 23rd. You know, a bit like we commemorate battles and so on. Worcestershire, any idea? Herefordshire, comparing it to Trafford, okay, fairly posh part of Manchester. But Herefordshire, you don't associate with not being posh, and it's where the middle-aged members of the royal family go to have parties. Gloucestershire, compared to Newcastle, Kirklees, Charnwood, Gwynedd. Somerset, more Leave voters than Dyson, Harrogate, Stockton, on Tees, Hartlepool, Middlesbrough, Hambleton. Right, there's been numerous Southern journalists who've gone up to Hartlepool to ask people why they do it. None go to Somerset. Bristol, remember that aberrant place of hippies who don't know what they should be doing? Only 38% voting Leave, but compare it to Edinburgh, right? You can't say Scotland's different. For every case you can find somewhere in the north compared to the south where there are fewer Leave voters, even somewhere like Bristol. Wiltshire, more Leave voters than Bridgend, Swansea, if you know your stereotyping, Bury, Berkshire, beating East Dunbartonshire, East Ayrshire, Barnsley, Boston. Boston, I won't get back because we've got that time. Oxfordshire. And again, even though it's only 43%, because people in Oxfordshire go and vote, so the turnout's higher, you get more Leave voters in all these parts of the north. Buckinghamshire. Surrey. More Leave voters in Surrey than Mansfield, Rotherham, Newark, Rushcliffe, Fife, and what was the West Isles, and Renfrewshire. We don't think of it like that, but that is the absolute numbers, and there were more on the electoral roll. And finally, London, and this is where I went slightly wrong, because I ran out of northern areas. By the time I looked at London, I should have put a north-south divide line slightly further north. London has 1.5 million Leave voters. All the other areas I'm left with only have 1.258 million. to even London. And there's the other areas to get London. Finally, then, do you remember the city of London? Right, we're going to find you an area outside the southeast of England with even fewer Leave voters than the city of London. Right? I thought this was a challenge, but here's the answer. It's Gibraltar. Sorry, it pleased me. You are lovely enough to appreciate that. It was kind of thing that makes you happy. So what I'll try to get you first. Oh, it's marginal. It's 52%. You have to put some effort in as you create this jigsaw to make sure in every single case it's more. But it is not fixed. It is not possible to fix that. By social class, according to Lord Ashcroft's survey, Lord Ashcroft, bless him, spent a huge amount of money on this survey, an exit poll. A really big one, because he thought they were going to lose the first time. Why else would he have done it? And he needed to produce the evidence of how we were robbed and so on. 59% middle class. Confidence limits, because somebody had a go at me on Twitter and said, oh, it's a survey, it's really variable. The survey is so enormous. The 95% confidence limits are 58 to 60% of leavers. A social class A, B, or C one. Why we can't accept this, I don't know. Because he tells a different story. Working class lad went to a comprehensive in the north of England. True hero of the people. Drinks green, always has the same beer. Green King IPA. He didn't really go to a comprehensive in the north of England. He isn't really a champion of the working man. Political slides, last two, and then with a break for a drink, and I've managed to do it on 10 past. So what I'm mainly interested in is talking about, and that's what I most want to talk about, and then a question about why. But I'm most interested in why people can't accept that the majority of Leave voters voted Leave in the South, not because there were a bigger electorate in the South. You notice the electorate was always smaller in every single case. But partly because of turnout, partly because they just wanted to leave. And you can understand not getting the story right on the day, because it was a shock. In W1A it was a complete shock. The spread betting, which had got every election right recently, said that the Remain were going to win marginally. They had a script, and the script went wrong, and they had to make it up on the night. And they went on their prejudices, which is not people like us. Who is not like us if we're sitting in the studio in West London? Well, the people furthest away from us. And some of them was convenient. And I can understand that on the day. I can even understand it for a month afterwards, or 2 months, or a year, or 2 years, but 3 years after the event, not to actually say that this vote, which was only called because of political party, which gets almost all of its effective support from the south of England, put it in a manifesto, and then argued for it, and its own voters voted for it in the south of England. I just don't know why we don't get that. Two last things, because you're bored of all that, you want something else. Why did the negotiations go so badly wrong? There are many, many possible answers to that. Some of you may not believe that they went wrong. Very long negotiations for a long time. Standard & Poor produced this graph before the referendum. It was a graph of how affected would all the other countries of Europe be if Britain was to leave, as their estimates. And what's really interesting about it is they got Ireland kind of right, although actually Ireland's done extremely well. If you look at building in Dublin at the moment, it's not doing badly, but Ireland clearly most affected in some ways. Then Malta. Malta's very small. And then Luxembourg, because of the city and money. Luxembourg is very small. And then Cyprus. Cyprus is very small. And then Switzerland, which gets no say because it's not a member of the EU in the negotiations, again because of the financial connections. And then Belgium, which is pretty small. And then the Netherlands, which is okay, medium. And then finally Spain, which is going to lose some money, but is no longer going to have to provide, depending on what happens, healthcare to those people we send out there. and saying to young people that this is educating, sent to school and to university at its own expense here to do the crappy jobs we don't want to do. That was the deal we had with Spain. They took our old and we took their young. Well, some kind of pie pipe with pandas. We were in no position to bargain. And it was known 3 weeks before. Brexit's been really, really interesting. I think it's educational. I wouldn't have picked all this up or known or even predicted. We're not as strong a country or set of four countries as we thought we were. That's, I think, what we've learned. And we'd never have known it. If it had gone 52-48 the other way, well, we can talk about that after a beer. Personally, I think 48-52 this way is perfect. In hindsight, if you go through all the scenarios of what could have happened otherwise, I don't think Nigel and Boris and Dominic Cummings would have gone away if they'd lost by 2%, put it that way. Mm-hmm. Lastly, what's going to happen next? Because people often ask what happens next. We're in uncharted territory, but at least because we're nerdy, we can prove we're in uncharted territory. This is one of those weird diagrams again. It's the support for Labour in the polls. Each dot is the average of an entire month's polls. If you average opinion polls, all the ones you get from all the posters over a month, you actually get a number that's a bit stable, otherwise you'll get something jittery. I never tweet those polls that people keep tweeting. They will look at my party's doing when I tweet it. You need to average an entire month of polls to get a dot. May 2015, Labour's hovering at 33%. Corbyn comes in, party fights itself to death, goes right down to about 26% by February 2017. You would have to be a complete idiot not to call an election with the opposition on 26%. Because for the entire history of polling, whenever that's been the case before, the party with the highest support has done really, 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 really well. It took some convincing to convince Theresa she needed to call that election. But they convinced her to call it, and it was a sensible thing for her to do. And then this thing happens. A 2.5% jump in April, a 6% jump in May, another 6% jump in June, and 2% jump in July. You have to believe me, but I have drawn 2,000 of these for every political party for every period, and never have we ever had that. And that tells you you're in uncharted territory. What happened at the election 2017 doesn't have a precedent. People in Britain before have not changed their minds so quickly and decisively. Keep on moving and moving and moving. These are the swings as conventionally measured. Attlee got 10.4% over 10 years and a war. Right. Wasn't expected, I'm going to ignore all the little ones. Foot. Old man, mumbles, communist, Marxist, traitor. Minus, getting into character again, minus 9.3%. Blair, first election, landslide, 8.8%. But rather like Attlee in the war, 18 years of Conservative rule, some pretty awful opposition leaders, and the country's sick of it. Next two elections, Blair loses votes. Minus 2.5 swing, minus 5.5 swing. It's not a good record. Admittedly, he had stacked load up. Gordon Brown, who admittedly had the biggest financial crash since 1929 to deal with, managed to make Blair look good by losing 6.2% on the swing. Doing really badly. Ed Miliband, I should have a picture, 1.4% swing. That's very good compared to Brown and Blair. It's just that Miliband would have on that record to have stood for another 12 times, which takes 60 years for Labour to win. And then the man who can't lead, who doesn't want to lead, who can't do a speech, who doesn't know where he stands, who's probably a communist, 9.6%. It is stunning. And the thing I'm going to leave you with, this is what's really interesting. What normally happens after a huge swing is you win. And what normally happens when you win is you disappoint. Well, you get in and suddenly within a year it's not a land of milk and honey. You have this manifesto, and what actually happens is that it's good. The position you want to be in is to have a really big swing, but not win. Because then you can't disappoint. All the things you promised, that wonderful nationalised railway system, nobody having to pay to go to university anymore, decent social care, a health service provides, all of it can exist in your imaginations. Right? Which means that we haven't reset the bar down again, which means we have no idea. I think the Brexit Party getting so much support in the last few days is another indication of we are all over the place. Right, I think the one, I've trying to say it, but at least you can say there's some evidence. We really, really, really do not know what is possible. And that includes right across the political spectrum. Anything from a medium Labour landslide to a Labour-SNP coalition with enough votes to not have to worry about anything else, through to the one country in Europe which moved most of the far right in the last 20 years, actually voting for something which we've never voted for before. Mosley had a go in the 30s and didn't get very far. That's possible. Anything is actually possible now. The only thing I really want people to do is accept who voted for this. Because I lived for 10 years in Sheffield and I lived for 10 years in Newcastle, and I really don't think it's very fair on people there to say it was them when it was us. Thank you very much, Mo.
Just before we start the Q&A, I just wanted to point out that first, Don has a hard stop at 5 past, so we're going to catch a train. And the main point I wanted to make was that it's obviously a very political issue, and Q&As are for questions and not statements. If you want to make a statement, if you want to make a point about Brexit, we meet on the second Wednesday of every month in the bridge. You come down, have a pint, have something to eat, and we'll argue the toss over it there and then. But please, please, please try and keep your questions nice and short, nice and succinct. Question ends with a question mark and not a full stop. Kate's going to do a run around the mic, and I'm going to ask the first question. Ask the first question. do you think it will go any different if there's a second referendum?
Okay, brilliant question. Not that different, it would be my guess. Partly because we've been polling people ever since Trump got out, John Curtis, and his Sir John Curtis, chief nerd of voting. Only in the last 2 weeks has finally said he thinks that the second referendum would be for Remain, just. My personal view, my wife and my daughter went on the march, I just balance, I didn't. My personal view is, I do think there's a lot of money there that would chuck in to try to get leave, and the tabloids would be affected. But also personally, I'm against referendum. I was against the first one, so I think it'll be difficult for me to argue for a second. I think the geography would be remarkably similar. What would it achieve if the second referendum was 52% Remain, 48% Leave, which is what's predicted? Well, that's the problem. Where would it get us? I'm trying to be technical, not to put my answers. It's really hard.
Thank you. First of all, thanks very much for that. That was a really interesting talk. I've got a question. You said that people confabulate when asked whether they voted or not. Do you have any information to say whether they remember voting differently to the way they actually voted?
Yeah. Well, in general elections, they often, depends how it's done. So they often try to please the person, just a physical human being in front of them, and that in the past did mean over-biasing how often they said they voted Labour and not saying they voted Conservative when they did. This is why collecting data from a computer screen is better than actually having a person in front of you. But a lot of this is, we make a mistake of thinking it's rational. You don't sit there and think, I know I voted one way, I'm going to lie to the person. Most people, this is really important to remember, a good 30 to 40% of the population don't bother to vote. So we really know they're not that bothered. A few won't be able to get there, but they really aren't. There'll be another 10, 20, even 30% who this is a marginal decision to bother. And the danger is that if you're interested in this stuff, you think other people are like you. And the most sort of stupid question to ask people in an opinion survey is, if there was an election tomorrow, how would you vote? Because it is not on the top of most people's minds at all. There are lots of things that matter in life. But actually that question doesn't give you a particularly useful answer until there is going to be an election and you've had time to think about it. And I think we overstate how much we can say about ourselves. I do, since I started worrying about this, I begin to get really nervous about myself and my own views and my own political behaviour and so on. You know, we are animals. We are very, very fallible. And suggesting that the whole thing is so set in stone, I think it's what I showed you earlier, the kind of the far right spiral where it collapses. After the tabloids have whipped up hatred, you can get 10%, 14%, even 20% of people to vote for parties that essentially are, I would say, nasty. But the tabloids stop doing it the day after the election because they don't need to, and the people who own them can't bother. And then the support just dies away. So it isn't a sort of steady rise. Most opinion isn't set. Even people who are very political can switch from one party to another. You know, occasionally candidates do. That's not there. You've got to choose, you've got the mic, you've got the power.
Given the changing in the voting pattern that seems to happen, what do you think the impact will be on first past the post? Will this influence what MPs and those in power think about introducing more proportional voting systems than they currently are using? Or are they too entrenched in the, you know, they've got too much advantages to the current system to want to change?
I mean, it's very rare in Europe. So, in general, first past the post dies. It's also very rare in this country. So, Scotland doesn't have it, the Welsh elections don't, the London election doesn't have it. The elections that we're almost certainly going to get on, is it May 16th?
23rd.
Okay. First past the post stays the number. The only problem is that whoever gets in favours it at the point they got in. John McDonnell is against it. Jeremy Corbyn, for some reason I can't fathom, is still for first past the post. The Conservatives are always for it. I once went to a Conservative Party conference, I think in 1999, in Blackpool, and it was fascinating, with the one Conservative MP who wanted PR, trying to argue for PR. In 1999, when the party were at its lowest, and doing really badly after first past the post, and they were adamant that they believed in first past the post. So if it happens, it will happen when the Conservatives aren't in power. Remember Dominic Cummings' last win was Aaron Matthew Elliott, who ran the Leave campaign, was absolutely trouncing the no to AV. They weren't no to AV, they completely won that one. So their track record on referendum is actually quite good to win them. But I think first past the post is doomed. I don't know almost anywhere else on the continent that has it. I'm sure somebody will know. It's just not a normal thing to do. The sad thing for PR is we have a PR system for these European elections. And the bizarre thing about what's happening, the Liberals, I think, only won one seat in the southeast of England. So you could actually have a PR system which doesn't deliver people what they vote for. But most people are not going to be that popular about it.
I left-leaning people will hold very sincere reasons for voting Brexit. I understand 60% of the Westminster constituencies that voted Labour. 60% of Labour constituencies voted for Brexit. What percentage of Labour voters voted for Brexit?
Oh, it's about 30%. About 30% of Labour voters. So it's 60% of constituencies represented by a Labour MP. Of those people who voted in the referendum, just over 50%, maybe 55%, voted Leave. The people who voted Leave were disproportionately normally UKIP or Conservative voters. In the north of England, and they came out. You know, this is a referendum for you. If you're UKIP, you do not vote in the whole thing. The whole point about the fact you voted for UKIP all those years was to get this. So you have near to 100% turnout of UKIP voters. Whereas if you're told by the spread betting and the media that Remain's going to win, and it's got to be said, an MP is stabbed to death a few days before, at which point if you are a really bad Liberal, you just think, well, that's it. You don't go and vote. And that was part of what happened. The biggest being sincere I've seen is the very, well, the very old. The very old voted Remain because they can remember the war. That's the early 90s. But the 70-year-olds and early 80-year-olds who voted Leave were voting for their grandchildren, which is what 70-year-olds and 80-year-olds do. They were not voting for themselves, they were voting for a better country for their grandchildren, because they grew up in a country in which you could start a family in your 20s, in which you could get a mortgage, you could buy a house, you could create a life, you could have employment, you could go to France and have a bloody good holiday on very little money, and they've watched it all go. So I think it's a very, very sincere, actually, Leave vote for the majority of Leavers about really worrying about future generations. Not only their struggling children, who often can only get a mortgage for something that's pretty crappy if they can get a mortgage and may well be renting, but the grandchildren, what hope have they got? You know, massive university loan in the case of the majority of the daughters, the granddaughters, no jobs for life, renting from a landlord for the majority for the rest of their lives, and the paper you read tells you that they're competing with all these immigrants coming in. So the least you can do for your grandchildren is vote Leave. I was asked this question at the talk. I think the level of sincerity was actually higher amongst some of the Leave voters, the reason for it. As you can tell, I don't agree with this will actually help the grandchildren. And I also think there's lots of ways in which you can ensure that somebody can get a house, start a family, have a job, without having to leave the European Union. Given that the European Union contains the countries in the world with the most stable employment, best housing systems and so on. I do think we haven't recognised the sincerity that's there. And partly because there was some really overt racism. The men who were 3 years old in the 70s who were in the National Front at my school, I know, who are now 2 or 3 years older than me and in their mid-50s, will have absolutely voted Leave and loved it. But they were a minority back in the 70s and are a minority now. The big majority of Leave voters were voting for the generations beneath them. The sun at the front. Okay. Yeah.
Do you think that if Corbyn and the Labour Party had campaigned forcefully and positively for a Remain vote, pointing out the benefits to the working population that come from Europe, then there would have been a different outcome?
Yes. Yes. Well, it doesn't take much to shift. So supposing, I mean, Corbyn did do a lot of pro-EU speeches, but supposing he'd been a better speaker then, and was able to do soundbites rather than go on, it would be really effective. And he goes for a whole series of things. I think at most they could have got a 4% swing. And in hindsight, had they done that, Leave on 48%, massive, would have had no investigation. We'd never have known about the dodgy money. We'd never have known about Cambridge Analytica. Everything would be blamed on the immigrants. That would have ramped up and up and up. We have the most incredible rise in anti-immigrant stories before the referendum. The story would have been that the elite bias BBC and the Trade Union Congress and the church and the universities and the CBI and the every single part of the establishment stitched this thing up. And the 48% of true heroes have been robbed, led by Boris, who on the day when he got 48% had been jubilant, rather than looking absolutely crestfallen as he looked. The only Boris couldn't disguise how upset they were. Their idea was that they would be the champions of the working man. This would make Boris, Cameron would have had to have gone with a very narrow party splitting thing. Boris would have got in. Gove would have been this kind of creature from Lord of the Rings. This is why I say I'm actually, in hindsight, I did talk in favour of Remain before the vote, and I now think, I'm glad I did, and I was being honest, for my generation this is really, really important. Most of my colleagues who I've written books with recently are from the mainland, and they've all left. My English colleague, who I wrote the Mumfrey book, who's from Nottingham, is now in Hong Kong, because his wife is Dutch. So why the hell should he hang around here? Imagine if it had been 52-48, we'd been told how wonderful Empire 2.0 could have happened. All the fantasies, we would have had an amazing negotiation. The Germans would have had to give an interest because they need a market for their cars. And if somebody like me said, oh, we'll end up shutting down our car plants in Swindon and Cowley, we'll actually end up buying even more German cars in future, just the really small ones, I'd have been laughed at. Whereas, this is the thing about it, I agree Labour could have done a lot more and could have pushed it, but had they done it, I don't think we'd be looking at a second referendum and a much more virulent Conservative Party than we necessarily are, although we have no idea. We have no idea who's going to take over that party. She may not go right away. Given her track record of not actually doing what she says, the fact that everything she's going to go in December, I think is amazing. The one thing Theresa does is not what she actually says she's going to do.
Can I ask you a slightly different question? If there were to be another referendum now, then quite a lot of the older people, the majority of whom voted Leave, would no longer be with us. But we would have a lot more young people with the right to vote, which, assuming they use it in the same way as their similar colleagues of 18, what sort of impact could that demographic change actually have on a potential referendum?
Yeah, the people have tried to estimate it. I mean, it's not only that, of course, we're the oldest and the died. We're the only European country that actually has falling life expectancy now. So even more will have died because 2014 was our peak. Our life expectancy has come down since 2014. People tend to move towards the right as they age. We're beginning to understand, it's not what lefties like me necessarily think. There's amazing discoveries being made about political opinion and behaviours and beliefs. So you're up against that. Then also, most people are very, very, very valuable. In fact, we don't think we are. And I'm talking to you in this room and saying you and I are the same and we know our minds. But actually, we're probably equally valuable in some particular way. I mean, if you're thinking of voting for a definite Remain party, you probably don't know if you're going to vote for the Tiggers or for the Liberals or for the Greens. You know, it's easily switched, or for Labour, because that's definite. So we're easily moved. A referendum under certain law can only have two questions, and that's difficult. Choose one or two questions. I would take a long time to set up. It falls down on this basic thing of it's a one-off. Yeah. Why is this something that has to be decided by a referendum? Why can't it be decided by Parliament? So my preference, and I've said this for 2 years now, is my preference is revoke. And I thought we were going to revoke out of desperation. But we've actually lost the medium-sized banks. They've gone, the headquarters are gone, the staff are going to take 12 years to go. It's interesting because I don't particularly like bankers, but they're moving because they no longer, regardless of what we now do. My preference is revoke. I thought we would be on a crisis and then we would have to. I even thought that might be Theresa's plan. And then what you say is any political party who wants a referendum promises it in their manifesto. And
but what about young people? Would they make a difference to a future
vote? Young people will make a difference if there is a generational change. This is the really fascinating thing. Your politics tends to be set when you're young, and then it can drift. So my mother's politics was set when she was 15 in the Suez Crisis. She can remember going to Leeds Town Hall, and that was the point at which she decided. And of course, this is where I get my politics from, because most of us, the biggest predictor of us all individually, actually, it's, depending if you're my age, it's normally your father. My mother was much more dominant than my father. It's your parents. There are particular generations. The 45 generation was one who had their beliefs reset. The 45 generation who came back, and this was unpredicted, the men, but also the women who had to wait for the men to see whether the men came back alive or not, who weren't their boyfriends or husbands, couldn't forgive an elite. You know, forgiving one world war that was supposed to last weeks and went on for 4 or 5 years, you could kind of say that's unforeseen. But you know, elite building things up to allow that to happen for a second time, and you having to go out to fight, that caused the generation to come back with no trust in their elders and do something very different in 45 and August. It's possible that Brexit and climate change is doing the very same thing right now. I think the level of protest now, certainly a mess, is past the little 1968 peak that we had. The French were really good at 1968. We were small, it was the NSC. Yes. Almost 1,000 arrests in London, I think, is a record. I think we've actually managed to get them out of bed by annoying them. you know, it took burning the planet, not caring about their futures, being xenophobic, and even their grandparents voting away they didn't like, even though they didn't say their grandparents voted for them. But I happen to think this is a moment of very big change for a young generation. And then some of us, but most of our opinions, how many people have altered their political beliefs substantially from, let's say, the year 2000, like long 19 years ago? How many of you would, I'm not going to ask you, I promise, I'm going to ask you what you are now and what you were, but how many of you are on the other side of politics from 19 years ago?
I think, given the average age of this audience, you need to go a lot further.
But this is why the setting, once somebody votes for the first time, we know they vote again and again and again. It's almost, because you know, it's actually quite a scary thing, because you more probably will vote. It's a weird thing to do. It's like going to church and praying, because it's religious. Your actual chance of your individual vote mattering is essentially zero. You'll take a part in a ceremony and a collective belief like praying. But once you do it, once you pray once, it's much easier to pray again, and once you vote once, it's much easier to vote again. And they voted, they came out and voted in 2017. And you know, they're set on a particular track. But I am a ridiculous optimist. You know, I'm constantly looking. The nerdy reason to be optimistic is whenever you're an extreme, we are the country with the highest income inequality, the only country in Europe, of 28 countries, the only country in Europe with falling life expectancy, one of the worst neonatal mortality records, about to be Romania by 2030. And go on about it. Whenever you have a table and the country's at an extreme, almost always it isn't about 10 years later. So we probably are going to change, but I think we've managed to annoy the young enough. The highest student fees in Europe, sanctioning them who are on benefit, a level of sanctions which were higher in total, the amount of money that are sanctioned mainly from the young, more than all the fines of all the magistrates' courts of England and Wales and the sheriff's courts of Scotland, is how much people have been sanctioned. That was just in 1 year, in 2014. Watching homeless people. Outside my department in Oxford, there's a tent with four people in it. Six people died since November in my town. Two of them went to my school. I had to go do a talk in my old school on Valentine's Day and say to the kids, this is happy school in Oxford, more children from this school have actually died on the streets of Oxford than have gone to the University of Oxford. And that's the extreme. But food banks. You know, if you're trying to galvanise a generation to be angry, telling them if you work really hard you can be extremely rich will work for a few of them. But not the more numerous ones. You work out what their chance of getting into the 1% is. You know, and your chance is obviously higher if you're numerous. It's a bit higher than 1%, but it's not that high. Anyway, I can get carried away with this. I'm constantly looking for signs of sea changes. And I would love to work out a set of tests set, because the trick is to set a series of conditions and say, it would be so remarkable if these hurdles were passed that we could then say, you know, I don't know, 2,000 or less in a week. What kind of thing would be required to actually say something has changed?
One quick question, Mark?
Yeah. Is this the last question?
Yeah, 2 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you. There's lots of talk about bubbles and social media, meaning that you only see what you believe in the first place.
Yeah.
I don't have Facebook, I don't do Twitter.
Yeah.
But since the referendum in 2016, I can count 3 people I have had met who have willingly told me they voted for Leave.
Yes.
Nobody else. What is your opinion on how to get people to talk to each other?
It's a very last one. The not mixing with people not like us thing began in the 70s. So I've got a maps of political segregation. Back in the 50s and 60s, remarkably high numbers of people voted Conservative and Labour everywhere. It was really close. You know, Liverpool was full of Tory voters. Scotland was full of Tory voters. I think it was actually a Tory majority in the 50s. So you had friends and neighbours who voted for a different party to you. And then at every election since 1974, October, the segregation index of voters has risen and risen and risen up until 2015. So geographically, if you live down here, I mean, you've got to come all the way up to my... You've got to come to Oxford East. I'll show you what a Labour MP looks like. There's probably one on the south coast somewhere.
Southampton,
you've got one. Yeah. It's a long way, isn't it? And then west, you've got to go all the way to Bristol. So we polarise spatially, and we polarise spatially within towns. It doesn't matter if your house is a slightly posher 1930s semis with that little Georgian frontage. Bang up, they go 100,000. You know, so that difference, where we're slightly poorer, ex-council, landlord, buys them, all private rented, it's kind of down. School league tables, the instruction of them in the 90s managed to absolutely cut cities apart. The area with the school with a very tiny advantage, you move to if you care about your child, if you could. And so we geographically divided long before we then only read each other's posts on Facebook and Twitter. Being all in it together, I think, helps. I think being in a situation where, even if you're in the top 10% of society, if you're not in the top 1 or 2%, and you haven't got substantial inherited wealth, by which I mean 100,000, and if you're rich, by the way, that's nothing. 2 million is the minimum, you know, it's poverty. You're lucky, I can go on about the super rich and what you need. I think being in it all together, in a position, well, I have 3 children, I am well paid, I have just managed to buy a house in Oxford. I grew up in Oxford, I know inside out. I wrote the Penguin Book of the Housing Market, published just before I bought a house. Right? I used to work for a builder. Anyway, I just managed to get a house. It's a very small house, we fit in it. My 3 children have got no chance. Absolutely none, no matter how well, because there aren't some millions coming down. So as a professor at the University of Oxford, way up in the top half of the top 10%, it's in my vested interest for society to be fairer and better, selfishly, for my children. If I had 1 child, it wouldn't be, because they could keep the house. Right? It's having 3. But and this may be a silver lining of Brexit, because economically, as we fall down, which is what's happening, we're falling down largely together. If you don't have enough money to fly to the Caribbean island, you are in trouble. And so you've got more in common with other people. Now it's very, very different. I'm worrying about my children's housing futures and trying to avoid them having to buy a rent for the whole time. But if you want the parallel, and I know the parallel, and my mum in 1956, Syria was the point of acute national embarrassment. Everything was going wrong. The Americans told us we couldn't do it. We came back shamefaced. Within 7 years, we were in the middle of the 1960s, and things were changing, and the country was happening, and so on, because people had rejected an old way of behaving. Now, if Suez can produce you in the 1960s, Brexit by the mid-20s could produce you something very interesting. Not a country that's any more the 5th or 6th richest in the world. We're already the 12th, which you count in what the pound's worth. It's just that that will come out next year. But you can easily be a country that ranks 20th or 21st or 22nd in the world, where most people are happier and more stable. And it's working out that that's more important than trying to be number one. And it's when people are well off, like me, and people who are not well off, work out there was a common interest in that. I think you've got a chance of things getting better. Thank you for putting it with me.
Thank you very much.